Okay, so we have a new handout, handout 7, which I just passed out. We'll also be referring to the handout previously that has figure 4 on one side and then a bunch of coins on the other side. If anyone needs those, I have some extras here too. Does anybody need that one? We're in the section on the Ptolemies and Seleucids, the period of time after the division of Alexander's empire. And this is kind of the last of the big historical things that we'll be looking at, which will take us up to the Maccabean Revolt. And so you remember from last week that I mentioned that this was a very tumultuous period in history. There was a lot of stuff going on, a lot of wars. We mentioned the six Syrian wars. And remember now we're talking about the Ptolemies, which are named after one of Alexander's successors, Ptolemy. And they basically were the rulers of Egypt. And then up in the north, in the Syrian area, as well as eastward into Persia, we have the Seleucid Empire, which was named after Seleucus, which was another one of Alexander's generals. So last week, we talked about that introduction, and we talked about the period of time, which was sort of the first 100 years of this period. The dates here are about 301 BC to 198 BC, so it's kind of about a 100-year period where the rulers of Egypt, the Ptolemies, were basically in charge of, in control of the Palestine area. There was still a lot of wars and things going on with Palestine as the sort of the battleground, as we were talking about last week. But over this 100-year period, the Ptolemies had the upper hand in the Palestinian area. And we talked last week about the first four rulers, and you can see all of the family tree on figure 4. And you remember we have the Ptolemy dynasty down the left-hand side, and down the right-hand side we have the Seleucid dynasty. I know it's kind of hard to read, but last week we covered the first four Ptolemies on the left-hand side. Now, I mentioned there's the Seleucids on the right-hand side are happening at the same time, so this is all happening in parallel. But we focused on the Ptolemies first, and after the fourth one there, Philopater, we are going to switch over and kind of use the Seleucid line as our sort of guiding point on how we're going to follow the rest of the history. And we'll go back this morning and take a brief look at the first four or so Seleucid rulers as well. So that's kind of orienting you to where we are. Well, you can keep that figure 4 in front of you. We'll be referring to that. You can see which one of these guys we're talking about. And then just to summarize what we said last week, at the end of the Ptolemaic period, we did a quick summary about, sort of the state of affairs. And remember we talked about Alexandria. So one of the important developments during this period was the further development of Alexandria in Egypt, in northern Egypt. Remember, that was a city that was founded by Alexander the Great. And over this period, with the first two Ptolemies, we've got the establishment of the great library in Alexandria, as well as the academy there and the museum. We talked about all those things last week. So it was a big development in Alexandria, where it really became the center of the Greek-speaking world in the Mediterranean area. And that pretty much became a center of thinking, of Greek thought, for centuries after that, into the Christian era, as we mentioned last week. So what was going on with the Jews during this period of rule by the Ptolemies? Well, the Jews had a lot of religious freedom under the Ptolemies, and so the Ptolemies did not interfere with their religion or culture. They were interested in Hellenization, but it wasn't a forced Hellenization. It was more of a sort of infiltrating with the Greek culture that Alexander had brought to the area. And so in general, the Jews had freedom of religion during this period and had good relations with the Ptolemy rulers in Egypt. And that brings us up to sort of a change in command here, which turned out to be very important for the Jews in Jerusalem and led to a period of great trial and tribulation. And that's what we'll get to today. So this is where we'll be picking up on the new handout, handout number 7. So we're switching over now from the period of Ptolemaic domination of Palestine to Seleucid domination of Palestine, beginning around 198 BC. This period is much shorter, as I mentioned last week. The Ptolemaic domination was around 100 years. This period that we're now entering is much shorter, more like about 30 years, just to put it in perspective. So we'll just do a brief review here then. While we went through the Ptolemaic dynasty up to the first four rulers and described those leaders and what was happening under their reigns, we'll now take a step back and look at what was happening in the Seleucid kingdom in parallel with that. So we want to kind of quickly cover the rulers up to Antiochus III, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth one down. So we'll quickly go through the first four. So the first of those was Seleucus I, and he was the founder of the Seleucid dynasty. So this was one of Alexander's generals who was, you know, retained a part of the empire when it was divided up. You remember we described all of the battles that were happening among Alexander's generals, the four people that are mentioned in Daniel, right in the first 20 years when his empire was divided up. Well, while all that was going on, Seleucus got into a little bit of trouble with Antigonus. You may recall him, if you have the map, you can remember that Antigonus was ruling part of Asia Minor there, the Phrygia region in Asia Minor. And he was the one that was champion of unification of Alexander's empire. Well, when all those wars were going on, Seleucus had to take refuge with Ptolemy for 3 years until Antigonus was finally defeated. So there's a relationship between Seleucus and Ptolemy here where Seleucus had to actually go to Egypt and basically in hiding until they could unite against and defeat Antigonus. And that happened in 301 BC. I bring that up because there is a hint of that in Daniel. If you're reading either chapter 8 or chapter 11, you can see that there. Seleucus is the one that founded Antioch as the center of the Seleucid Empire. So Antioch, if you remember, becomes an important location during the New Testament. It's the place where the Christians were first called Christians in Antioch, and you remember that Saul and Barnabas had sort of their initial center of ministry there in Antioch. It's also the place that precipitated the controversy over circumcision, if you remember, when some Jews went out from Jerusalem up to Antioch and were troubling the people with what they were teaching. You remember that from the book of Acts. And so Antioch was founded by Seleucus I. It's named after his father, Antiochus, and you'll see that name recur over and over again. As we said, you'll see these same names occur over and over, Seleucus and Antiochus. Anyways, he founded that as the center of the empire, and that really becomes the capital of the Seleucid Empire. He was killed in 280 BC when he was trying to go westward into Macedonia. Remember, there were still battles going on, you know, basically turf wars going on, trying to solidify each of the empires. And so while he was trying to expand his empire westward, he was killed in Macedonia in 280 BC. His son took over, and his son, not surprisingly, is named Antiochus I. He has this title Soter, which you may recognize means savior. He earned the title Soter by defeating the Gauls in Asia Minor. So he was continuing his father's push westward. And since he had some success there in Asia Minor, he earned the title Soter. Later, he did lose territory in battles with Ptolemy II. You may remember from last week, from what we said before, that Ptolemy II was expanding his father's territory also. They were all interested in expanding their territory. And he lost some territory in the battles with Ptolemy II. And then he was still fighting in Asia Minor, and he was defeated and killed in a war in Pergamum in 262 BC. You remember Pergamum is in modern-day Turkey. And so that's the area where a lot of battles were taking place at this period in time. So he had a son. His name was Antiochus II. And you can see him on your family tree there. He continued the war with Ptolemy II until peace was declared in 250 BC. And this is described in Daniel, so I will get my Bible here. I'll be reading quite a bit from the book of Daniel in this period. I'm going to read here just a couple verses from Daniel chapter 11 that describes what was happening here with these two rulers. So in verses 5 and 6, the king of the south, remember, whenever you see the king of the south in Daniel, that's the Ptolemies. They're in the south. And the king of the north is the Seleucid kingdom. Okay, so in verses 5 and 6, it says, the king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days she will be handed over, together with her royal escort and her father, poor child, and the one who supported her. There's a translation note there on father or child. So you see here an alliance going on with a marriage in view. The king of the north will marry, basically, a daughter of the king of the south. And that's precisely what happened. This, by the way, is a great example of the political intrigue that happened pretty much all throughout this period with alliances, pacts made and then broken. There's just, you know, all kinds of stuff going on during this period. It's very interesting. So this passage is describing the pact that Antiochus II made with the Ptolemy ruler, Ptolemy II. He confirmed this pact by marrying the daughter of Ptolemy II, whose name was Berenice. And the problem, of course, which was often the problem in these kind of arrangements, was that he was already married to someone named Laodice, and you can see her on the right on your family tree there, just to the right of his name. So he divorced her in order to enter into this political alliance with the Ptolemy ruler. So he basically divorced Laodice, and he married the daughter of Ptolemy II, Berenice. Well, he abandoned Berenice 4 years later in return to his previous wife, Laodice, which is what you can see in the passage I read in Daniel. It's describing that. And as a matter of fact, Laodice ended up murdering Berenice and her son. She also, by the way, ended up killing Antiochus II also. So she poisoned her husband as well, no doubt out of revenge for all of this political business that he was trying to pull. So it ended up bad pretty much for everyone involved. And you can see that referred to in Daniel where it says, the daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days, she will be handed over. That's a reference to the fact that she was murdered along with her son. So what ended up happening because of all this is Laodice ended up poisoning her husband Antiochus II. So he's done now. And that brings us to the next one on the list, which is Seleucus II. You can see him on the tree there. This was the son of Laodice, and he was established as the ruler after Antiochus II was murdered. And now we can keep going in Daniel here. We'll read the next two verses, which describes what's happening here. In verses 7 and 8, it says, one from her family line will arise to take her place. He will attack the forces of the king of the north and enter his fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold and carry them off to Egypt. For some years, he will leave the king of the north alone. So you can see that's now referring to a king of the south who's going to make trouble for the king of the north. Well, the way this actually worked out in history was that Ptolemy III, who was now the ruler of Egypt, invaded the north because of the fact that his sister had been abandoned and then actually murdered by the Seleucid ruler. So Ptolemy III made war on them, and he invaded the territory. He actually, it says in Daniel that he will enter his fortress. He actually took Antioch, the capital. So he invaded, took the capital, and subsequently made a peace treaty with Seleucus II. That's, you can see that referred to in verse 8 there. This was called, by the way, if you're a historian, this was called the Laodicean War because it was prompted by Laodice's actions and her being cast off by her husband at this point in time. So there was a peace treaty made here, and then Seleucus II died in 227 BC. He had a son, Seleucus III, which you can see off to the fifth row down, off to the left, has Seleucus III. He's listed off to the left because he only reigned briefly for about 4 years. He was assassinated by conspirators in 223 BC. So you can see the political intrigue here, just one trouble after another for these rulers. Murders and alliances, treaties made, treaties broken. And you may have picked that up before from your reading in Daniel if you were, you know, have read through these sections before. It just sounds like chaos. And that's pretty much what it was. Remember, this whole period that we're covering here is only 30 years, so this happened fairly rapidly. Okay, so that brings us to Antiochus III. Now, Antiochus III was the one who asserted control for the Seleucid Empire over the area of Israel and Palestine. Antiochus III was called the Great because of his victories, and we'll read about him now in Daniel, again, chapter 11. I'm picking up at verse 13 now, and I'll read down through 19. I'm not going to unpack all the details of this prophecy, but when you hear the king of the north, it's really a description of Antiochus III. Okay, so just keep that in mind as I read this. For the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years he will advance with a huge army fully equipped. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. The violent men among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Then the king of the north will come and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. The invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land and will have the power to destroy it. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom, but his plans will not succeed or help him. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them. But a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back upon him. After this, he will turn back toward the fortresses of his own country, but will stumble and fall to be seen no more. That brief prophecy there is pretty much covering the life of Antiochus III in a quick nutshell. So we'll unpack this now, see how this actually played itself out in history. Antiochus III was the younger brother of Seleucus III. That's why they're shown right next to each other on the family tree there. He took the throne of his brother when his brother was assassinated, and he inherited a very disorganized kingdom at the age of 18. You can see how disorganized the kingdom was, with multiple people being murdered, and then Seleucus, his brother, being assassinated by conspirators after only being on the throne for 4 years. You can see, by the way, if you turn your, flip your sheet over, there is a coin here with Antiochus III, and there's a misspelling in Antiochus there, but you can see the diademed head of Antiochus III, and you can also see the war elephant. Remember, we talked about the war elephants before and how important they were in some of these battles, and you can see the inscription there. So he minted his own coins. Now, he won a major victory, which really turned the tide of power to the Seleucid dynasty. He defeated Ptolemy IV's general, his name was Scopas, at the Battle of Panaeus. You might recognize the word Pan in Panaeus. That's Pan, the Greek god. And that location is at the source of the Jordan River. I mean, it's still there. You can still go there and see the shrines to Pan at the opening to the Jordan River if you go there into Israel. But he won a major battle here at that location in 198 BC, and that really gave him control, gave the Seleucids control over Palestine at that time. So here we see the balance of power shifting from the Ptolemies to the Seleucids. Now, Antiochus was generally kind to the Jews. Many of them supported him in the battles against Ptolemy. And this is really a root now of future conflict within the Jews, within the people of Israel. What you tend to see are these two parties emerging, some with pro-Ptolemaic tendencies and allegiances, and some who had switched allegiances to the Seleucids. And this is going to become important later on. It's another one of these subtle divisions that's happening within the Jews that led to wars and things later. There was ultimately a council of elders, this is within the Jewish leadership, that actually came to a vote. Which one of these rulers should we support? Should we be loyal to the Ptolemy ruler, or should we switch allegiances to the Seleucids? They actually had a vote in the council of elders in Jerusalem, which the result of the vote was they agreed to support Antiochus the Great. And so when he came to conquer Jerusalem, they welcomed him, basically. And subsequently, he provided many benefits to the Jews because of their welcoming attitude towards him. Josephus describes some of the benefits in detail in his Antiquities. So that's kind of what happened now. As a matter of fact, do I have a quote there from Josephus? This is the testimonials he's referring to are the description that he's just given of how Antiochus was kind to the Jews. But he says, "Now these testimonials which I have produced are sufficient to declare the friendship that Antiochus the Great bare to the Jews." And so the Jews now have moved from one pretty good ruler over them, if you can have a good ruler from outside your nation, the Ptolemy ruler, over to another pretty good ruler, Antiochus III. Now, you might have heard when I was reading that another daughter involved here. And so here's another political alliance that was made. Antiochus gave his daughter in marriage to the Ptolemy in Egypt. This was Ptolemy V at this point in time, if you're looking at your family tree there. What he was trying to do was basically marry his daughter into the family so that the offspring, he'd have an in there, basically. So he'd have an offspring that was really part of his family that he could establish a strong alliance with the Ptolemies. It didn't work out that way, but that's what he was trying to do with this political arranged marriage. So some of the other artifacts of his reign, Antiochus really worked hard to continue to push the Seleucid territory to the west, towards Greece and Macedonia. But now, there's a new power that's coming on the scene, and who might that be? Anybody want to take a guess? Unless you've already cheated and looked on your outline. Dave? Rome. So we haven't mentioned Rome yet, but there's a lot of stuff going on in Rome at this period in time, and a lot of wars happening, which I haven't mentioned, over in that area of the world. And really what's happening is the Roman power is beginning to rise. They're starting to get victories in that area of the world. They're starting to expand their power and their influence. Well, he was pushed back at this point in time by the rising Roman power. So now we're not talking about really Greek power anymore. We're talking about Rome beginning to become a world power. And he suffered, Antiochus III, suffered a crushing defeat in Asia Minor at this point in time. This was in 190 BC. And this was a huge crushing blow for him. He was forced to surrender his war elephants and his navy, and he was forced to pay a huge indemnity to the Romans at this point in time. This is described in the book of 1 Maccabees. His son, Antiochus IV, who you can see on the family tree there, was taken as a hostage to Rome, and he remained there for 12 years. Antiochus IV is going to be a major player here that we'll talk about shortly. But he was taken as a hostage to Rome. Now, this was a very common practice back in the day when they would defeat a king, and the king would give his allegiance to the conqueror, but they knew that he was going to renege as soon as their army, you know, returned home. So the common practice of the day was they said, okay, well, we'll accept your allegiance and we'll take your sons along with us as hostages to make sure that you don't renege on the deal. So this happened over and over again at this period in time. And you'll see in the subsequent rulers here, and this actually carries all the way down into the reign of the Herods in approaching the New Testament era. You'll see a lot of political prisoners, hostages really, in Rome. Well, his son Antiochus IV was taken as a hostage, and he remained there for 12 years. Now, because he had to pay such a huge indemnity, which basically he had to pay cash to Rome, they were demanding that he pay them, he had to raise money somehow, he had to get money somehow. And the story goes that he went to the east, so he went over towards Persia to try to raise money, and he was reportedly plundering a temple in order to pay his tribute to Rome when he was killed by an angry mob who rose up because he was plundering their temple. So this happened in 187 BC. And so that was the end of Antiochus III, and he's out of the picture. Well, his son, Seleucus IV, had a relatively uneventful reign. You can see his reign was fairly short. He reigned about 12 years. And then he was assassinated by his prime minister in 175 BC. Now, here's where it starts to get really complicated. If you think it hasn't been complicated so far, it gets worse. This is very challenging, first of all, to understand, and second of all, to present in a way that's at all coherent at this point. He was assassinated by his prime minister, and then his son, Demetrius, had replaced Antiochus IV as a hostage in Rome. So when Seleucus came to power, remember, his brother is now a hostage in Rome, if you can follow that at all. Antiochus IV is his brother. It's his younger brother. Well, how well does a younger brother work as a hostage is one thing you might ask. Answer, not as good as your son. And for multiple reasons. First of all, your son is, you know, your blood that has come from you, and that, you know, you probably can't bear to see suffer or anything like that. Secondly, if you're a ruler, and this wasn't necessarily the case here, but if you're a ruler and your brother is a hostage, what politically does your brother represent to you? A threat. Right. And we'll see this over and over again in the coming rulers here as well. Yes, Bill. That's right. Yep, that's an excellent point. And as you mentioned, this is part of the human condition. It's a human power play. And if you believe that you are the one that gets power, and then you need to retain the power, you need to do everything in your power to make sure that there aren't any threats to your kingdom. Remember that theme, because it's going to become very important later when we get down to the Herods. And we are going to get to the Herods eventually, believe it or not. Anyways, picking up on that thread then, what happened is when Seleucus became the ruler, his brother Antiochus was released from Rome. And his son was then taken as the hostage. Okay, so his son, and his name was Demetrius, had replaced Antiochus IV as the hostage in Rome at this point in time. Well, Antiochus, of course, once Seleucus was assassinated, he's now the rightful ruler to the throne, or the heir to the throne, or there's some question about that. But he came to the throne, because the real heir to the throne is who at this point? Demetrius, the son of the ruler. When a ruler dies, it doesn't pass to his brother, it passes to his son. When we read in Daniel, you'll see some hints of that when it's describing Antiochus IV, that he's kind of not the rightful heir to the throne at that point in time. Yes, Bill. I'll just comment briefly on it. So I think the question is, first of all, the question was, is this a prophecy in Daniel? And secondly, sort of, How are we to understand that prophecy? And how are they to understand the prophecy, the original audience? So first of all, yes, the answer is there. It is a prophecy. And we have both in chapter 8 and 11, and we're actually going to be reading a lengthy portion next. So good segue, Bill. We're going to be reading Daniel chapter 8 and chapter 11. But this is a prophecy, and you know, there's a lot of mystery here in terms of the original audience. Daniel himself was perplexed by these visions, and he didn't fully understand them. So two points to make. First of all, one thing that we can see looking back on these prophecies now in history, and kind of what you were saying, Bill, what I'm describing now, I've read the prophecy, which happened, you know, hundreds of years earlier. And now we're seeing how it actually worked out in history and how accurately it worked itself out in history, which is one of the reasons I've been saying over and over again that people who don't believe in predictive prophecy believe that these passages were written after the events occurred because they're so accurate. And now, of course, we believe in predictive prophecy because if you are making the future, you can certainly predict the future, which is the case we have with our God. So one of the things that we want to say is, you know, we're looking back on this, and this is one of the cases where we can actually see how accurately the prophecy was fulfilled in world history. The second thing I wanted to say is, and you picked up on this point, Bill, is that certainly Daniel and the original audience would, this is pointing them, and you were kind of alluding to this, that we shouldn't be wrapped up in the kingdoms of men. We should recognize that God is the ruler of all world history, and he's accomplishing his purposes to bring his kingdom in. And in this case, this is pre-coming of the Messiah. So the next big historical event that we're looking for here at this point in time is the coming of the Messiah. And Daniel certainly had that perspective. I mean, if you read through Daniel, he's sort of consumed with God's overarching rule of the kingdoms. And we looked before at the prophecies of the world kingdoms. And this is also in Daniel, earlier in Daniel, you know, the statue and the four beasts. All of those things are just an unveiling of what God is going to do. And he's, you know, revealed that to Daniel. And again, it actually very accurately worked out that way. But definitely the overarching message is there's a kingdom coming, and that's in those prophecies in Daniel. You remember he talks about the coming of the kingdom at the end. During the historical setting for the coming of the kingdom is the Roman Empire, which we saw in the visions of Daniel. But the kingdom is coming, and you definitely see that note of, and I can't remember the exact words, I want to say the rock that will fill the whole earth, which is, of course, Christ and his kingdom then that will, you know, go to all the nations and everything. So definitely that's the overarching rubric here that you are intended to pick out of this is all these things are happening, yes, but don't forget God is sovereign over all of this and is working out his plans for world history. Yes, Jen? The question is related to the prophecies of Daniel and then this council that I mentioned where they voted to determine where their allegiances should be. What was in their thinking there? Do they have this kind of thinking? First of all, as I mentioned, the records are very sparse here. So probably, and I don't have this note here, but I believe we're relying on what Josephus said about the council. There's no details there other than that it happened. The one thing that kind of touches on what you were saying, though, is, and we'll get to this, is the priesthood and the councils at this point were very secularized. So, and of course, we know there were godly people still in play here, and God's remnant, of course, is still there. But the rulers at this point in time, the high priests, there was a lot of political and secularization going on within the priesthood. And we'll be covering that in a week or two, I think. It's not to say that that wouldn't have been a consideration, but it also could have been very political. Like, what's expedient for us here, you know, from a human, you know, horizontal perspective? Who should we align ourselves with? So it's hard to say what was actually in that decision, but yes, John. Right. That's right. And we'll see that, you know, some people, we see in the New Testament, some people hadn't lost the big picture. I was just reading this morning from my devotions, I was reading again about Zechariah and the coming of Jesus. how Simeon was in the temple, and it says that he was looking for the redemption of Jerusalem. I was thinking about that. You know, so here's a person who hadn't lost the big picture. He was looking for the redemption of Jerusalem. And we read elsewhere about people looking for the consolation of Israel. And we see a lot of those themes, by the way, in the Qumran community, that's another thing we're going to get to eventually here. But there is a remnant that certainly hadn't lost the big picture, and we're looking for God to do something. But it is a good, I think, John, the kind of point you were making is we need to be careful about trying to figure out all the details and the dates and things like that when we have a prophecy like this, you know. And we'll even see that a little bit here in Daniel when we read this passage. There's even sections in here that I think most commentators believe were not fulfilled at this period in time that are probably looking forward to the end times now from our perspective, not from their perspective. The end times here were happening for them, you know, of course, when the Messiah comes. But there's still a future fulfillment to happen for a lot of these things that we're looking forward to now. So we're a little bit still in that same analogous situation where we're still looking forward to another major thing that's going to happen yet when the Lord returns. If there's no other comments or questions up till here? There is one more. Okay, Bill. You're going to take us out here, so that's all right. Did they back the right horse? Well, they did initially, but we're going to find that this led to big trouble later. We're getting to the big trouble right now, actually. Well, they did in one sense that the Ptolemies were losing power at this point in time. The Seleucids were definitely in power. And, you know, to some extent at that point, again, for expediency, you're just trying to understand what is going to be most safe for us at this point in time in history for our city. Should we, you know, be capitulating to this ruler or that ruler? I mean, we see the same thing in the Old Testament where, you know, the Jews are trying to decide who they should be aligning with. And you even remember that King Josiah went out and he opposed the Egyptian king when he was marching to Assyria and he was killed, you know, in that battle. It's all providentially. But even back then, you know, who are we aligning with? Assyria, Egypt, Babylon, or Egypt? You know, that's the battle that was happening during the fall of Jerusalem. Should we be aligning with Babylon? Should we be aligning with Egypt? And you know the story. They kept relying on Egypt, the splintered reed, and it ended up, you know, from a human perspective, it ended up with the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. So did they align themselves with the right person? Well, they definitely aligned themselves with the people who were in charge, in rule, in power in that area at the time. So if they had aligned themselves with the Ptolemies at this point, if they had remained loyal to the Ptolemies, they would have been crushed. So they probably did the right thing from a human perspective.